turn off the lights. In the dark, a violin starts playing from under the table. No one is touching it, yet it plays. Then the table itself rises up from the floor. It hovers. Flowers appear from nowhere. The medium is a Sicilian woman. Her name, Eusapia Palladino. We are in an elegant house in Paris. Eusapia rises from her chair, but she's not standing. She's levitating. Then she projects herself in time and space. Spirits talk through her. Eusapia's ethereal voice orders you to hold hands with your neighbor. That could well be Pierre Curie, a physics Nobel Prize winner. He discovered piezoelectricity, the force that is today powering sonar, DJ turntables, and induction stoves. Curie takes fastidious notes. Next to him might sit his friend Albert Laborde. He discovered nuclear energy. Or his former student, Paul Langevin. He translated Einstein. These guys are no fools. They're world-class physicists. They deal in forces. They discover forces. Could there be other invisible forces? Forces from beyond? Sure, why not? They've just discovered radioactivity like half an hour ago. Still, they're not discounting the possibility that this is a scam. That's why Curie takes such precise notes. But they would never be able to prove it. The modern spiritualist movement started in the United States some 50 years earlier, in the middle of the 19th century. President Lincoln's wife is an ardent practitioner, hoping to get in touch with her deceased son. Then the fad takes Britain by storm. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the father of Sherlock Holmes, also lost a child. He became one of spiritualism's strongest advocates, even opening a spiritualist bookstore in London. Meanwhile, some of the best minds of the time, including writer Charles Dickens and magician extraordinaire Harry Houdini, make it their business to disprove the paranormal claims. Yet the fashion spreads throughout Europe. When spiritualism arrives in France, it takes on ideas of spiritual healing and reincarnation. It becomes the elegant pastime of the literary elite, the aristocracy, and the bourgeoisie. Then, like everything that's fashionable higher up, it trickles down. And that is how we arrive in the mining area of Pas-de-Calais, in the north of France. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts, Jelby the Durian, and for a limited time only, Husalino the Capybara. And welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosity. Augustin Lesage is 35 years old. He's digging for coal in pit number 2 of the Forfait mines, like his father and grandfather before him. Suddenly, he hears voices. One day, you will become an artist. Augustin is scared shitless. What are these voices? Augustin thinks they may have something to do with his sister, who died when he was 3 years old. Wait, hang on. An artist? Augustin, like most people in the French working class at the time, can barely read or write. A painter he is not. The voices seem to know that, as they tell him, Grab a pen and paper. We will give you the references of the brushes and colors you'll need to purchase. Apparently, Augustin cannot count too well either. He makes a mistake when ordering his first canvas. The piece is huge, 3 square meters, nearly 10 by 10 feet. It's too big to fit in his living room, so he rolls up the bottom part of the canvas that's lying on the floor. He starts painting in the top right corner. Meanwhile, he tells a friend about the voices. The friend introduces Augustin to spiritualism. Augustin proves an exceptional medium. He tries automatic drawing, letting his hand be guided by invisible forces, not exercising any conscious control himself. He is sure now that spirits are talking to him. A lot.
Don't try to understand. Follow our advice. People will doubt your paintings. Scientists will probe your art. You will find that ridiculous. Just do as we say.
3 weeks later, Augustin is still working on the top right corner of his massive painting. You see, Augustin has no idea you're supposed to start with preliminary sketches, particularly for a canvas this big. He just dives straight in, color on brush. Brushes, to be exact, he uses one brush per color. The pigments are pure, straight from the box. He doesn't mix them with one another. Maybe he hasn't yet figured out that you could. And what he paints on the enormous canvas is minuscule, row after row of diminutive columns, gardens of miniature plants harboring microscopic birds. But there's an order in there, a symmetry. It looks like the blueprint of the royal gardens at Versailles crossed with a Cambodian temple. Like the back of a samurai's kimono had a child with the elven city of Rivendell. It is a world unto itself. Augustin spends a long time on his first painting. He paints in sections. He gets to the middle part, slides the top up along the ceiling to access the yet unpainted lower half. It takes him 2 years. Not full time, though. The man is still working down in the mine pits, 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. Then, the world opens up from under Augustin's feet. Some foreign leader was shot in some faraway city over some distant territorial dispute. For reasons he cannot fully understand, this means France is at war. He's still young enough to be drafted. Besides, the fighting happens pretty much at his doorstep. Augustin goes to war. He comes home sick, gets better, goes right back to painting. He finishes his first giant painting in 1916. The effect is absolutely stunning, or it would be if anyone other than his mining friends in this desolate area of Pas-de-Calais could see it. The eye wanders along imaginary architectural constructions like an unfolding origami of the Tower of Babel. You move closer to take in the smaller details, but the architecture abruptly stops at the edge of a void, so you take a step back and wonder. These blank spaces around the constructions, what are they? If they're the sky, why aren't they blue? Why is everything so straight and square? How come the blank spaces are so curved? They feel organic, like giant insects, like human arms and legs. They impart movement. The painting is alive. Post-war France has a hunger for modern art. Somehow, word of Augustin's work reaches Paris, probably helped by the fact that he's got a good story. A miner who paints is one thing, but a painting miner whose hand is guided by spirits? A painting miner who claims to be communicating with Leonardo da Vinci by way of seances in the middle of nowhere? In 1923, the editor of spiritualist magazine, La Revue Spirite, becomes Augustin's patron. Up to then, Augustin wasn't making money with his art. On the rare occasion he sold it, he would charge precisely the cost of canvas, brushes, and colors, to which he added the hourly salary of a coal miner. Now he can quit his miner's job and paint full-time. Also, now he can travel. He claims to believe that in a former life he was a construction worker on Egyptian pyramids. Throughout the years, ancient Egypt has become a strong inspiration source for him, sometimes finding its way onto the canvas in literal form. Notably, he paints a harvest scene that wouldn't be out of place in a pharaoh's mausoleum. Finally, in 1939, Augustin obeys a new injunction from the Voices. Along with a group of similarly minded artists, he embarks on a guided voyage to see the real thing. Once in Egypt, Augustin gets the shock of his life. In the Valley of Queens, he visits the tomb of Mena, a scribe for Pharaoh Thutmose IV. On a wall, in the center of a large fresco, Augustin discovers what he claims was his harvest scene, exactly as he painted it. So, was Augustin guided by spirits? Was he hearing voices? Was he the reincarnation of an Egyptian pyramid construction worker? Early on in his career, people start doubting. Some doubt that he is guided by spirits. Others are questioning whether Augustin himself actually believes he is guided by spirits. So in 1927, at the height of Augustin's career, enter the International Metapsychic Institute. Metapsychic, not metaphysical, last you to Metapsychique Internationale. What these guys do is study spiritualist phenomena with an emphasis on debunking claims and exposing quacks. Augustin is invited to a reunion of the private club in Paris. Every day, for 2 months in front of a packed audience, Augustin paints. The canvas is 6.5 feet long by 5 feet wide. Spectators remark that not only does Augustin forego sketches and canvas preparation, he paints smoothly and very fast. Without hesitation, like a machine. For all we can tell, these skeptics are convinced. 3 years on, in 1930, Augustin meets a man named Fleury-Joseph Crépin. Both are from the poorer, hard-working north of France, the Rust Belt of Europe. Fleury-Joseph is a locksmith and a plumber. He is also a spiritual healer. 9 years later, as World War II is declared, Fleury-Joseph hears voices too.
You will paint 300 paintings and the war will end. Then you will paint 45 more and the world will achieve universal peace.
Fleury-Joseph grabs some brushes and gets to work. His paintings closely resemble Augustin's, and he claims to go about them with the same method. He finishes his 300th painting on May 7th, 1945. On the very same day, General Alfred Jodl signs the documents recognizing the complete defeat of all German armed forces. The next day, other members of the Supreme German Command sign similar documents. The war, at least the European front, is over. So, Fleury-Joseph, not content with having single-handedly ended World War II, figures that the prophecy has been right so far and embarks on a new series of 45 paintings. He dies in 1948, having completed 43. The world has yet to achieve universal peace. Augustin has led the way for a whole generation, a whole movement of younger artists inspired by spiritualism. They paint, they draw, they sculpt, they sew. The art world calls them spiritualist artists. At the end of the war, Paris dedicates a whole exhibition to them. Jean Dubuffet, at that point a painter of major importance, falls in love. He starts collecting their art. He writes about them in art magazines. He coins the phrase art brut, raw art, later called outsider art. That is the ultimate stamp of legitimacy. That, there, legitimacy. It is exactly why Augustin's story matters beyond the niche domain of art history, beyond even the fact that he uniquely brings together major art currents like surrealism and pointillism, or that he'll directly inspire the creation of abstract art by influencing Kandinsky and Mondrian. Legitimacy. When he dies, in 1954, Augustin Lesage is a major figure in the outsider art movement. He leaves 800 paintings. Today, some are centerpieces in European museums. Others are the propriety of spiritualist circles. Yes, those exist to this day. Augustin's very first work, the 10-by-10-foot untitled canvas, hangs from the ceiling of the Museum of Outsider Art in Lausanne, Switzerland, like the door to the royal dais of a cosmic ruler. Augustin was a miner, Fleury-Joseph a locksmith. Other spiritualist artists were from the working class too. Matching the demographics of spiritualists at large, many were women. Claire Dissot, who wrote this whole episode script for me, says, "This is what started it all for me, the shock. I used to work in museums, sort of. I've had a few artistic shocks. They all have something in common. You recognize a small part of you in there. You see it, it sees you. It bypasses decades of education, of culture, of knowledge, like looking a wild tiger in the eye. It's not the wildness that's disturbing, it's the kinship. Except that Augustin for me wasn't a flicker in a tiger's eye, it was the whole tiger, the whole jungle. He was displaying the blueprint for my idea of beauty, my sense of how the world should be if it were beautiful. I wasn't even thinking, good grief, man, how do you know? I was thinking, yes, this is exactly right. This sense of relief, this sense of peace is indescribable." Who were these artists? In the environment of the times, Dissot claims, there was absolutely no way any of them would have attained any sort of recognition, let alone made a living off their art, if they hadn't claimed to hear voices. They probably wouldn't even have had as much recognition today if not for that story. And the spiritualism and the working class background feed on each other. Clearly this is authentic, beautiful art, because he comes from a working class background and is guided by spirits, but clearly he's guided by spirits, because how else would he know how to paint something so original and so beautiful? Remember when Augustin painted in public at the Metapsychic Institute? Here is a quote from the director of the institute. "It is astounding that an uneducated man with no family members in the arts, a simple coal miner, would reach this form of art." The art-loving bourgeoisie found it more believable, more acceptable, for a member of the working class to spiritually connect with Leonardo than to become an artist through sheer talent. And it took a while for that to change. In 1964, half a century after Augustin's first painting, the French Minister of Culture asks the Committee for Historical Monuments to recognize and protect another astounding creation by a self-taught working man, the ideal palace of Facteur Cheval. Cheval was a postman. He would collect stones along his daily run and assemble them into a unique monument. The ideal palace draws from Egyptian, Indian, and Christian influences and brings them together. Cheval inserts minuscule details and homewritten poetry into a dreamlike temple that took him 30 years to build. The monument Committee's report is overwhelmingly negative.
Absolutely hideous. A deplorable pile of absurdities mangled in a boorish brain.
If the Minister of Culture in question hadn't been André Malraux, an admired writer, political figure, and member of the wartime resistance, the ideal palace would have crumbled to a heap by now. Malraux named it a cultural landmark in 1969. In 2020, viewers of France's Channel 3 ranked it the country's second favorite monument. Chauvin started building his palace in 1870. At the very same time, another man of modest extraction, Henri Rousseau, starts painting. If you're French, you may know him as Le Douanier Rousseau, Rousseau the customs officer. He wasn't a customs officer, he was a tax collector. Same difference. Rousseau famously gets rid of what has been the hallmark of every single Western artist since the Italian Renaissance, perspective. Perspective is creating depth by varying the sizes of elements of decor along lines that meet at the horizon. What Rousseau paints is flat, like a child's drawing. At least that's what it feels like to the 19th century art lover. Rousseau does not paint elegant ladies sitting in elegant chairs. The first painting of his that gets noticed is wild. A terrified tiger is caught in a violent storm in the heart of the jungle. It is pure movement, not a straight line in sight. The jungle, to where he's never been, inspires Rousseau in a whole series of scenes. A famished lion pounces on an antelope. A jaguar attacks a panicked horse. Monkeys climb atop one another to shake fruits from a tree. In one of his most famous paintings, a mysterious figure clad in animal skin plays the flute, and snakes slither out of the woods to hear the music under the moonlight. You'd think he's a naturalist painter, but mostly what he paints is magic and dreams. There's a gypsy woman asleep on a sand dune next to her guitar, being approached and sniffed and probed by a lion, or is she dreaming of the lion? There's a nude lady on a sofa, a trope of classical art, but instead of painting her like one of his French girls, Rousseau beams her up into the middle of the jungle with more lions. The invisible is very visible to Rousseau. He was a fervent spiritualist. He, too, repeatedly claimed spirits were guiding his paintbrush. Did Augustin Lesage know this? I may have exaggerated his illiteracy a little bit. Augustin ran for mayor of his village and was elected twice. He had access to books and newspapers, so he could get a secondhand education. In art magazines, he could, for instance, discover the frescoes and the harvest scene decorating the tomb of Mena, the Egyptian scribe. They had been copiously documented and reproduced. Yes, he painted that harvest scene, but was that really the work of spirits? He could also have learned that the Douanier Rousseau was mocked and trolled and despised all his life, and that he died in such squalor he couldn't afford his own tomb. Augustin could tell that artists from the working class were referred to by their day job. Douanier Rousseau, the customs officer, Facteur Cheval, the postman, just to make sure no one would accidentally confuse them with respectable artists. He could see the movement around Rousseau was christened naive art, that his own current of spiritualist painters was included in outsider art. What else is outsider art? Music like The Shags and Captain Beefheart, the massive books of Henry Darger. Arguably The Room is outsider art. In Augustin's day, paintings like Rousseau's were the poster child for outsider art. All fabulous things that the world is richer to have, but by people who very much aren't taken seriously as artists. People who are seen quite literally as crazy. Today, a man claiming that spirits are moving his brush would be seen as crazy, and a coal miner teaching himself to paint massive psychedelic canvases in his spare time would be seen as a genius. But in Augustin's time, with the legitimacy of spiritualism and scorn piled on transgressive artists, it was the other way around. Did Augustin understand that the doors of the art world would never open for him if he followed a conventional path? Did Augustin Lesage and every spiritualist artist that came after him, as well as Rousseau and others before him, use the spiritualist fad as the only lever that was available to them to grasp for artistic legitimacy? Did they literally play dumb to escape their circumstances? Did they pull the greatest scam in 20th century art? Or did they truly believe? And at the end of the day, what does it matter when we have this beautiful art?